You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I get to start us off this week, and this week we have Victoria with us, which is very exciting. Woo, Victoria.
Hey.
Hey, welcome back, Victoria.
Glad to be here.
So, I have a story to tell you a little bit.
Excellent.
So, on the show, we've talked about mutualistic relationships between creatures before, such as when Victoria covered oxpeckers way back in episode 117. I say way back. Or when I covered, or I talked about lichens, which is like the first or second episode, which is further back.
Further back, yeah.
Yes.
Often, when we think of mutualistic relationships, it's between an animal and either another animal or a plant, or sometimes it's like a lichen where it's like two plants or maybe a bacteria and a plant. It's usually like outside, right? But we often exclude when we're thinking of mutualistic relationships? What do we often exclude? Any ideas?
Microbiomes?
You're right. Yeah.
Is that what you're going to talk about?
Ooh, no.
Okay, because you said outside. So I'm like, well, what's inside then?
We talk a lot about parasites, but that's not a mutualistic relationship.
True.
Parasitic relationship.
Oftentimes when we're thinking about mutualistic relationships, we never think about humans in that realm. Like, what are our mutualistic relationships?
Like with other humans?
We're all nerds, not necessarily with other humans, but with other organisms or beings. Do either of you know of any mutualistic relationships off the top of your head? I mean, there's the microbiome, but...
Dogs and humans.
Yeah, I mentioned the microbiome one because that was the first thing that comes to mind. All the flora and whatnot that lives in your gut. But it has to be mutualistic. Like, I think back to one of the really early ones that Victoria talked about in the show about the face mites that come out and crawl around on your face at night.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
Well, that's things I don't know. Like, do they help us at all? Like, are they actually... fighting off, you know, infections or something on our face by being there? I guess I don't know enough about some of those little critters to know if any of them are beneficial in any way. Certainly they are. We are their host, so it's beneficial to them. I'm not sure if it's how much reciprocity there
commensal
is in those things.
Commensal versus mutualistic.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Boy.
So
I'm sure there are some.
It's hard, right? So I'm going to tell you both a little story. So in Africa, on the savannah, there's this practice that is really common for a lot of the different, for several different communities of people called
honey
hunting.
Oh, I know what you're going to talk about.
Wow, she's quick.
Whoo! Okay, it's called honey hunting. If you do this, you are a honey forager. You are going
is this
out
what you thought,
and you're
Victoria?
Looking.
Yes.
Wow.
You know about this?
This is cool. Maybe. Ooh. We're about to find out.
This is so exciting. Okay.
Go ahead, Rachel.
All right. So if you are a honey forager, you're going out and you're looking for a wild beehive that has made a nest that is full of honey. It's generally European honeybees, and they've made honey in a tree in a cavity. And you're looking for this honey because in your community, it is a pretty significant source of calories. It's really important for your diet and for your people's palates and diets. People are in communities such as the Hadza people of Tanzania or the Yao community of Mozambique. it can make up to 10% of the calories that they need to consume in a day. So it's a really significant amount of food for them.
A lot of honey.
That's a lot of honey.
That's a lot of honey.
But you're on the African savanna. How are you going to find a beehive out there?
Do either of you have any?
I mean,
I know what the answer is.
Yeah, Victoria knows.
Follow a bird?
You might follow a bird. You're correct. So if you're one of the foragers, nice. What you're going to do is you're going to make a pretty special whistle, or you're going to make a brrr, hoomf, hoomf. Let me try that again.
can you
do that? Fantastic.
A burr. Mm-hmm. I can't trail my R's. Hoomph.
No, that was good.
Thank you.
All right.
And up to like 80% of the time, there will be a bird that comes fluttering down and about and starts chatting at you and making noises and flying. Now, you're going to follow this bird, and this bird will lead you to a tree or whatever cavity there is that has a beehive. It'll sit on a branch, and then it will quiet down, just be deadly quiet. Won't make a noise. While you investigate the tree, open it up, smoke the bees out, remove the honey, but you're leaving behind something that the bird wants. This particular bird eats the wax that in the comb
the wax.
Sure,
of
yeah.
the honey of the beehive.
I thought it was going to be the larvae.
Right?
But
it is
wax?
Generally the wax, actually, which is wild.
Yeah.
They'll
think
eat
that would
some
be super
of the
digestible.
Larvae and everything too, but I wouldn't think so either. But apparently that is what they do. Generally speaking, they do dig into the larva and will eat some of that too, but they're able to process the beeswax, which is most of what they are using. Now, here's something I want to tell you. So this bird is called a honey guide, and it is not domesticated. This is a wild bird that has a relationship with humans.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
And guides them to the hive. It is so cool. And like the bird itself doesn't look super special. It's a brown bird with like white cheeks and like a reddish orange beak and like a white chest and everything. It's not a very large bird, but it is a wild bird. And they do practice, like the bird itself is kind of wild just because it does practice nest parasitism. It's like super like to the point where the egg will be laid in some other nest with some other bird, and as soon as that the honey guide emerges from the egg, it proceeds to murder the rest of the nest mates.
Rather
than doing anything else. It's so nice.
And
it uses like the barbed ends of their beaks to actually do that, rather than like just shoving them out of the nest. It literally will kill the other birds. And as it grows, it learns how to communicate and work with the people on the African savanna. And it's just really cool because there's not a ton of relationships that we have where humans are the ones, generally speaking, who are going out and domesticating an animal. That's how our relationship with like cats or with dogs or horses or cows, like we get things from those animals, but they also get things from us. But that's also through domestication. This is a truly wild animal that they can't approach the nest themselves because the bees will go and sting them. But they have learned, if they talk or like are able to communicate in some way, fashion with a human, that, hey, there's a beehive right over here, that the human will take care of the bees enough that you, the bird, are now able to get some of the wax and be able to have some food, which is really cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do we know how long humans and honey guides have had this relationship?
So there's been some debate. It's not a really well known to Western science. It was first documented in the 1500s, but it's been going on for much, much longer than that. Just because documentation of it wasn't the best. It's not in the way that sure. Western science has mm-hmm. been around, but yeah. So at the very least since the 1500s, but it's been going on much longer than that, because this is a relationship between the honey guides and the indigenous African communities that are there. So,
and do we know if this is a behavior that honey, well, I guess if they're nest parasites, they can't learn it from their parents, so it must be instinctual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. See, now when you first yeah. started and talking about it, the first thing I thought of was like humans and wolves, like hunting mm-hmm. together sort of early on. And but you mentioned how like domestication is its own special thing, because like dogs would kind of be an example
right.
of this, if especially if they're like helping us hunt and whatnot, rather than just sitting in our lap like mm-hmm. my dog was today. Mm-hmm. But like it's interesting that you could see this sort of relationship as being what leads to domestication of a species.
I mean, it could. That it's very possible. Yeah. I will say, at least the Audubon Society, some experts, according to the Audubon Society, some experts, I guess, believe that it might stretch 1.9 million years. So
whoa.
We might be past domestication.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah. domestication isn't guaranteed. I'm just saying it could be a precursor
oh,
to
yeah.
that for species that are so inclined.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just a really cool relationship, because the other thing that I found when I was doing my research on this particular topic, just a fun little tidbit, is the fact that the birds are localized. Like if you took a honey hunter, a honey forager from Tanzania and put him in Mozambique, they will not, the birds, the greater honey guides is what they're called, they will not respond to the calls of the Tanzanian honey hunter, which is wild, and vice versa.
It's like the humans make different noises in Tanzania and.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Each community has their own specific noise for the birds.
Oh. God, so I thought it was going to be that the sound they were making was like imitating the call of the bird.
No, nope.
They just got their own unique.
They have
oh
their
my
own.
Gosh.
Wow, that's
they have
that's
their,
really cool.
Yeah, yeah, they have their own call that they have. That because the honey guides don't sound like that at all. They chatter, and I didn't actually listen to their call, but I know that they chatter. So definitely not like a
wow.
special whistle. So they're triggered for a specific sound from people to guide them towards a beehive. And the bird knows how to get a human's attention as well when they're looking and hearing that noise. So that way they can go and guide them, and then they can get food. It's wild.
That is super, super cool.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what I had for you both this week and for all of you out there. I just want to talk about honey guides. They're really, really, really cool. They're a boring looking bird, I'm not going to lie, but like the relationship is really cool.
that is awesome, yeah.
Had some really good information from the Audubon Society, had a great article about the Greater Honey Guide, as well as NPR had an excellent article by Nell Greenfield Boyce. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, it'll be Victoria.
Hey, we're back. I had one of those moments when doing research this week where there was a little side fact in the actual topic that I was researching that led me down one of those rabbit holes. And I am talking about the rabbit hole this week, and then next week I'm going to talk about the original topic, which, spoiler alert, is a type of bird also. Yeah, but the rabbit hole is the avian respiratory system, which...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I must have learned about this like in college biology. I think I maybe took a comparative anatomy class or something. I've completely forgotten about this. And it blew my mind. So, you know, birds are really amazing in a lot of ways. They can fly, obviously. And as we always tell students when we're learning about different groups of vertebrates, they are the only animal that has feathers. But there is something else that's unique about birds that's less known, and it has to do with how they breathe. Before we get into that, we need to do a little refresher on how mammals and most reptiles and amphibians breathe, which is pretty much all more or less in the same way. So we bring air into the lungs through the trachea, also known as the windpipe. And when one of these animals inhales, the air rushes through a series of smaller and smaller tubes in the lungs, which they branch and branch and branch, and each tiny branch ends in a little sac, which inflates. Sac's called alveoli. Mm-hmm. And then outside of each alveolus are tiny capillaries that carry blood. And then oxygen and carbon dioxide diffuse back and forth across the membrane between these two places. And so the blood gets oxygenated. We can breathe out the carbon dioxide and so forth. This is the way...
Yeah, that all sounds pretty standard.
Yep, that's pretty standard.
I have now, like, really, like, focused in on how I am breathing. Just thinking about breathing. I'm like, wow, look at my lungs go. Anyway, continue.
So, if you think about it, this type of respiratory system actually performs two different functions at the same time. So one function is ventilation, which is the process of bringing air in and out of the body. And the other process is gas exchange, which is our carbon dioxide and oxygen swapping in and out of the blood. And this type of breathing that we do is called tidal breathing. So you can sort of think about it like a tide coming in and going out. In birds, ventilation and gas exchange are two separate functions. They do not happen at the same time. I mean... We'll get into it. Yes. Okay. Birds have a whole separate set of organs to help them do this. And in fact, if you follow one molecule of, or one little packet of air, the whole breathing cycle of a bird takes two cycles of inhales and exhales to complete all of the functions.
What?
So wild.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't think I know anything about this. So...
I will
obviously
explain.
This is an audio medium, but my like face, like I just did the like second look, kind of like shaking my head, like what? Keep going.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild, and extremely functional. So, bird lungs are pretty much fixed. They're rigid. They're pushed up against the rib cage mostly. They don't expand and contract the way that our lungs do. And when a bird inhales, what actually inflates are a series of air sacs that are found in the chest and abdomen. The bird has 9 air sacs. They're just thin-walled tissue sacs, and they hold air, but they don't function in gas exchange at all. There are 3 that are up near the top of the chest, and we will come back to those later. And then there are 3 pairs, so 6 other air sacs, that are in the mid-chest and the lower chest and abdomen. And these air sacs, when the bird does its first inhale, the air comes through its trachea and goes directly into those sacs, which inflate. Then, when they exhale, exhale number one, the air is pushed from the rear air sacs into the lungs. Like a bellows pushing air.
Gotcha.
And the lungs is where the gas exchange happens. Now, on inhale number 2, the air in the lungs, which is now depleted of oxygen, actually gets pushed out of the lungs and into the three front air sacs. So yes, that's right. The air comes out of the lungs when the bird inhales.
That makes no sense.
Right. And then finally on exhale number two, the air is forced from the three front air sacs out of the body through the trachea. So these two cycles are, of course, actually happening simultaneously each time the bird inhales or exhales. So on each inhale, air simultaneously passes into the rear air sacs and also out of the lungs into the front air sacs. And on each exhale, the air passes from the rear air sacs into the lungs and from the front air sacs out of the body. I don't know if that was possible to follow what I was saying at all.
Without a diagram of some kind? Yeah.
I recommend, there's a really good video that I'll cite at the end that was helpful. But basically, air, it's a unidirectional system. So air only flows in one direction through the respiratory system. There's a continuous flow of fresh air into the lungs for gas exchange. They don't have to waste time breathing out carbon dioxide because every time they push air out, then fresh air is coming in right away.
Cool.
Yeah. Awesome. And this is an incredibly efficient system, and it is one of the main things that allows the bird to fly, because flying takes huge amounts of energy. It's a huge metabolic load, and it requires a ton of oxygen. And without this efficient one-way system, the bird would not be able to get enough oxygen to fly. And I haven't even gotten to the really weird part yet, which is that birds' bones are part of their respiratory system.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd talk about this.
Yes.
Hold on. So why are birds' bones part of their respiratory system? What?
You might remember hearing at some point that birds' bones are quote-unquote hollow, which is like supposedly
they're like
light
as air.
To fly.
Ha, ha,
yeah.
Ha.
Which is kind of true and not true. Light as a feather. Ha, ha, ha. So it's not like they're hollow, like completely empty, but they have these thin struts of bone material across the empty space that strengthens it. But there is a lot more air inside the bones than in mammal bones.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the bones, actually most of the bones, are connected to the air sacs. So it provides additional space for air to be stored and then pushed into the lungs. Which is just mind-boggling.
Uh-huh.
Breathing in and out of their bones. Yeah. There's like holes from the air sacs passing into the center of the bone.
And for some birds, as they flap their wings, that actually helps pump air in and out of those spaces as well.
Yeah, and birds actually don't have diaphragms the way that we do. The diaphragm's the muscle that does most of our breathing work for us. They actually just use their rib cages. So yeah, flying can be part of that process too.
I'm never going to look at a bird the same way ever again.
Go ahead, Kirk. Yeah.
Well, no, I was going to say something. I don't know if you were going to mention it or not. So I don't want to.
Okay. Well, just that there's some other adaptations too that make them super efficient. For example, the membrane between the air capillaries and the blood capillaries is thinner than in mammals, so gas exchange is more efficient. That was pretty much where I was going to stop. There's a lot more I can say, but I do have some extra cool things to talk about for our patrons.
Ooh!
But what were you gonna talk about, Kirk?
Well, maybe you're gonna mention this with there's been cases where they've had birds that can actually literally breathe through their wings. I'm reading about a case where there was a bird who had a broken wing.
Yeah,
and then they noticed that it was breathing, literally pulling air in through its broken wing, which is like, what? so utterly bizarre. But it's because, like you said, this whole system is just completely different to how our respiratory system works. So you could imagine if you broke your arm and you're like, I'm just breathing through this hole in my arm. What? That is bizarre. Birds are amazing, you guys.
Yeah.
I'm second guessing everything I know about birds.
What is this show for, if not for yeah, so I do have more I want to talk about. It's going to be a little bit in the bonus episode for our patrons. Sneak peek, it's going to involve non-avian dinosaurs and crocodilians.
Awesome. Well, that's a great time to remind people to, you know, sign up and become one of our patrons if you want to hear some of the bonus material we just don't have time to get to on the show. We'd love to post it up there. Anybody who's a member at any membership level gets access to our shows ad-free as well, which is pretty fantastic. You can go to patreon.com/strangebynaturepodcast to learn more about that.
I have so
and join
many
the
questions.
Society of Strange. All right, my sources this week, I relied heavily on the incredibly informative Avis Biology website, which is written by avian physiology expert Gary Richeson of Eastern Kentucky University. Side note, he also recently published a book called In a Class of Their Own, A Detailed Examination of Avian Forms and Functions. Extra points for the title, Gary.
Oh,
God, that is so nerdy.
Good.
Love it.
And also, as I mentioned, there was a YouTube video that was extremely helpful in understanding this process, which I probably confused all our listeners by trying to explain with words. The video is by Kelly Cage. That's Kelly with a K, Cage with a K, called The Avian Respiratory System.
We'll try to put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, it'll be Kirk.
Okay, everybody, here's the deal. I just got back from Hawaii yesterday.
Poor thing.
Darn.
I know.
Just rub it in my face, why don't you? I had a staycation.
I'm not actually able to sleep on airplanes usually, so that means we did an overnight, and I ended up being awake nonstop for 27 hours straight. We could do a whole episode on the effects of sleep deprivation.
It was not great. No, it's not fun.
So I am still a little wildly jet lagged. Forgive me if I'm not 100% coherent on this week's show. I will say, though, that Hawaii was amazing. I've visited the island before. It wasn't my first time there, but it was my first time I was able to spend meaningful time on the Big Island. And it was a pretty amazing experience. I'll be talking about a couple things on the show in the next few weeks. One in particular that was mind-boggling, but we'll get to that eventually. As a naturalist, one of the really interesting things to experience on the Big Island is the interaction between geology and biology. The island is still volcanically active with two volcanoes that are active. Kilauea last erupted in September of 2023, and right next door, Mauna Loa, last erupted in November of 2022. So both are definitely still active.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And as we drove around the island, naturally, it was all volcanic, but some areas looked like freshly covered and especially barren, while
probably
others
was.
Were lush with vegetation. And it was such a different experience than I'm used to here in Minnesota, where I happen to live, where the last volcanic action was around 1.1 billion years ago. So,
I see evidence of that here.
Up by you, Rachel, is where you can see that. It's all completely buried deep underground where I am. I have to travel hours to see changes in just even the basic biome that I live in. Whereas in Hawaii, you can see enormous changes in a matter of feet. Like, here I'm standing on fresh lava, here I'm in a forest. Like, it can be that sharp of a line. I did get a chance to hike through some ancient forests that were very, very old. And then you literally take a few steps forward and the forest disappears under a lava flow that might only be 100 years old. So this pretty sharp line between life and rock is not something a lot of us experience on a day-to-day process or day-to-day, part of our lives. So yeah, basis, there's the word. See, jet lag is getting to me. So it's a really cool thing to be able to experience if you don't get to experience it all the time. And there aren't, one of the things that's kind of a bummer, but I understand why, because it's a big island. There aren't signs posted everywhere to just like tell you the age of different lava flows. We also don't specifically know the age of all the lava flows, because they only started recording like specific ones in like a scientific way starting in the 1800s. There are definitely stories that have been passed down, like oral traditions that talk about when different flows happened before that. But of course, it's sort of like, it's a little more general. It's not down to the year. But I had to sort of, you know, look at some maps. And what's missing out there, I'll tell you, by the way, is if someone could create like a map with a slider where you could slide through the years and have the flows appear and disappear. I know all this data is in GIS databases. So someone needs to get on this, because that would be very helpful. And also, USGS, when you put out your maps, put current roads on those maps. Because if you're not from the place, or even if you're from the place, like, you don't, like, you need to have a place to know where you are at that time. Like, I crossed this road near this intersection and I saw a lava flow, and you like, look at the map and you're like, well, I don't know where that is on this map, you know? So the science communication needs to get a little better on that front. At one point, my wife and I were driving through an area that had a lava flow that looked completely fresh. Like, if you had told me it was from last year, I would have gone, yeah, that seems about right. There's just nothing there, completely barren. I had to study the maps before today's show to kind of figure it out. And I found that that brand new, crisp-looking lava flow was from 1936.
What?
That was only there off, like, 86 years, you know? And as someone who's not from that area, I don't have, like, the best sense of, like, how long it takes for these things to change. And it's very complicated, because it's not clear-cut how long it takes for life to return to these areas. It depends a lot on other conditions other than just the lava itself. Now, clearly, part of the reason that particular lava flow looked so barren is that it lacked soil. And I was reminded of a question I saw posted to the Ask Science subreddit like a year ago, when someone asked about dirt. And they said, we have the phrase, as old as dirt. And they wanted to know, how old is that? How old is dirt?
Great question.
So I'm going to put it to the two of you. It's a good question. I had a kind of gut reaction as a naturalist. If someone asks you, how old is dirt? Granted, little caveat here. Dirt is being formed all the time. So it's you can't give an exact answer. But if you wanted to give an average age, to like all the dirt on Earth, what's your gut tell you how old most dirt is?
Well, how are we measuring age?
My gut says 50
I assume we're not measuring
years.
The age of like the little bits of
nope,
rock.
Not the components. So okay. So refresher here. Soil is made out of rocks, usually like sand, water, air, and organic material. So the age of the soil would be when all those components came together.
I'm going 50 years on average across the planet.
50
years.
Okay.
That's just what my gut says. I'm probably very wrong, but that's okay.
That's totally fine.
I'd say, I don't know.
I'm putting you on the spot.
5,000 years, just going the opposite end of the scale from Rachel here.
Great.
I'm thinking like topsoil level.
Yeah. The answer I had in my head, my sort of gut reaction was, well, I'm going to go with like around 10,000 years. Because I know that at least here where we are, there was glaciation.
Right.
And there was the Ice Age ended 10,000 years ago. And I'm kind of like, well, you know, the Ice Age ended in lots of places about 10,000 years ago. Not everywhere, but that would be about how long soil has been building up in lots of places. But that was just sort of like based on a super hyper local, you know, sample of where I live.
Right.
And there were some scientists who were like, this would be a pretty cool question. So they looked it up, and turns out, if you kind of average out all the soil they sampled from around the world, it's about 10,000 years.
Oh,
all right.
It's about how old a lot of our soils are.
Okay.
Which, well, I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm just saying, like, I think the reason why is because of the last ice age scraped a lot of soil off the face of the planet. And then we've made new soil since then. So it's very much biased by, the data is very much biased by places that have younger soil. I'm calling it younger. The 10,000 year old is a young soil. But obviously we have soil that's like super new, for instance, on a volcano, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
or like any like compost, so, any like the leaf litter.
Yeah, exactly.
Or whereas I think if you went to someplace like Australia, the soils are very old.
Very old, exactly, exactly. So I was kind of thinking about this question of how does soil form on a volcanic island? Like, how does the land go from bare rock to lush forest? And one way to do this and think about it is to compare the relatively new Big Island of Hawaii to the older Hawaiian islands. And I was thinking about this as I was driving around, because I've been to Maui a number of times, and it's a relatively lush island. Even on the so-called dry side of the island, there's still a lot of plant life. And it's tempting to think that the islands can't be all that different in age, because they're all like right next door to each other. Like every day I was on the Big Island, I could see Maui across the water, like 30 miles away. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember the Hawaiian Islands formed on a hot spot in the Earth's mantle, oh, yes, where magma keeps on getting pushed up. And because the plate above them keeps moving kind of to the west or the south, southwest, the same hot spot keeps spawning new islands because it kind of stays in the same place. It is important to note, though, that this is a slow process. Hawaii moves about 3 inches northwest per year. So the Big Island itself is around 500,000 years old. That's like the oldest bit of the island. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some parts are only 6 months old. Maui, on the other hand, is 1.5 million years old. And if we keep on going west, Oahu is 3 to 4 million years old. And Kauai, the garden island, is 5.1 million years old. So basically, the longer an island has been around, obviously, the more soil can build up. And obviously, you're going to have much richer plant life there. It's why Kauai is called the garden island. I did have to look this up. The oldest Hawaiian island that's still above water is called Holanuku. I hope I'm saying that right. Holanuku, I believe is how you say it. Often sometimes called Cure Island, which is the name that was given to it by white folks who showed up there. This is 1,500 miles to the west of the main islands we know today. And it is estimated to be 30 million years old, and that was created by the same hotspot. So clearly, like, new islands have been made in this area for a very long time. So thinking about the new islands that are forming, though, they don't stay barren for thousands of years. Plants start to take over lava as soon as they can. And there's some variation in how long it takes, and it depends on how much water is present, what type of lava it is, what elevations it's at, all those things. But some plants can start to grow very quickly. The first two plants to come on the Big Island are usually ferns and the Ohio tree. They can both grow in very little soil. And like I said, soil is basically sand, water, air, and organic material. And the plants that grow there will eventually die. And as they die, they decay. And then they enrich that little bit of soil that's there with the dead plant material. And now you've got a little bit richer soil, and then a little bit richer soil, and a little bit richer soil as these cycles of plants grow there. Animals also very quickly explore new land, and they leave behind feces, which enrich the soil with organic material and also with seeds. So it's another way that seeds are coming in besides just the wind. And obviously, the bigger the lava field, the longer it's going to take. If there's just a narrow sliver of lava and then it leaves some existing, plants and things around it, some of the existing soil is going to get blown or washed into this flow relatively quickly. But if you have a miles wide field, that's going to take much longer for soil and seeds and plants and things to get into those area. And then lava flows in really dry areas or high altitude areas can take a very, 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 very long time to become lush, because there's just the growing conditions are terrible. And if the growing conditions aren't real great, then you're not going to get that buildup of new soil.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the same basic ways that new islands are populated by plants as well. Okay. If you have like a new island that was to pop up, birds from one island can eat seeds or even just get them stuck to their feet or feathers, and they can end up depositing them on other islands when they come to visit. And birds love little small islands sticking out of the water. Some birds can fly thousands of miles and bring life with them to new lands. And I remember seeing a graphic in one of the parks I was in that showed like how all the life came to the islands. And they're showing, you know, birds flying in from thousands and thousands of miles away and all the different ways, you know, animals blowing on the wind and stuff like that. And, you know, I think one thing we don't really think about is that birds don't necessarily have to fly thousands of miles. Like, new islands have been popping up in this same spot for millions of years. They don't need to get all the way from the mainland. They just need to get to the new island from the old island, which may only be like 30 miles away, right? So they're not having to go super far. Even though they're now just what we call underwater seamounts instead of islands, if you look at a map, you can see a chain of volcanic formations reaching all the way from Hawaii to the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia. The oldest seamount, which is an old volcano that's now, you know, underwater, is called the Detroit Seamount, and it's thought to be about 80 million years old.
Oh.
So you can imagine that plant species that are hopping from one island to another have maybe been doing this over the course of 80 million years, progressively getting further and further from the mainland as this hotspot drifts further and further from the mainland. So it's just, it's such a cool process how life has changed, what's going on the islands and how life spreads into new like completely barren land that's just pure rock, and you go, nothing can grow on that but a little bit of dust, a little bit of sand, some of these first plants get in there, and eventually you have this verdant, lush landscape, which is just fascinating. I mean, this entire process of how new land is sort of taken over by plants and animals, you could do an entire 100 series podcast just about it, because it's really amazing. And Hawaii so cool. is a strange and wonderful place where you can watch the process unfold, especially on the new island, you know, on the big island of Hawaii itself. You know, you can even find like a lone fern just growing in the middle of a lava field. And it's like, there it is. It's happening right in front of me in real time. And I don't have a time machine, but I, you know, to go back and watch it, or to go forward and watch how this would happen. I'd love to like hop my time machine and fast forward in the future to see how the big island is going to change. But like I said, I don't need one. I've been to Maui, and so I've made the million year jump forward to see the results, and it's striking. It makes me already sort of want to plan a trip to Kauai so I can see what a 5 million years jump looks like. 5 million years of erosion and plant life and decay and growth. It's just a short little hop between islands. Unfortunately, it's not a short hop from where I live, and so it does require a fair bit of jet lag. But just watching how these processes carry out on Earth, and to get a sort of a time capsule view of this line of islands stretching, you know, millions of years in time, and how plant life and animal life have changed and evolved on them, and have the ability to take over new, brand new land that's formed, is strange and wonderful and super cool. I hope other people get a chance to see it. If you ever go to these islands, be sure, you know, don't just go to the beaches and hang out and drink your Mai Tais and stuff. Get out there in the geology and the biology and explore the interface between the two, because it is a really bizarre and super cool thing to see. That's what I wanted to talk about this week. Most of my information on the ages of lava flows and such came from the good old U.S. Geological Survey. So you can check that stuff out. But that's what I got.
Awesome.
Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you so much. Cool topic.
Oh, amazing.
Thanks. That's this week's show, everybody. Thanks for stopping by.
Bye.
See you next week.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.